This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
Hey guys, welcome back to Land and Legacy Podcast. We're super excited to bring you another podcast this week as Matt and I sit down with Dr. Michael Chamberlain to talk about wild turkeys and specifically talk about wild turkey research, but most importantly, correlate that research with in-the-field land management strategy. So if you followed along over the course of the last few weeks, as we've talked about habitat, and then jumping back to podcasts we had last year at the National Wild Turkey Federation National Convention, we had Dr. Michael Chamberlain as well as Dr. Brett Collier on talking about all their research and various things they've learned. Well, we're taking that and spinning it into in-the-field management strategy. So let's take what we've learned in their research and how would we implement that as a land manager. So I think this is going to be probably one of my favorite podcasts ever in regards to what to do for wild turkeys. A lot of really interesting points that he makes about strategies that he would use, things he wouldn't do. Hint, hint, wink, wink. You gotta stay tuned for that one, because that's a good question and an even better answer. So before we jump in, though, I want to remind you guys about our habitat workshops that we have coming up in June and July in Alabama and Michigan. These are in the field, and there are training sessions where we will cover in outdoor classroom everything from all the different techniques we use in timber stand improvement or timber management to improve not only the health of your forest but habitat, ways to utilize different strategies to reach your goals as quickly as possible. We talk about edge feathering. We're going to talk about food plot management. We're going to talk about invasive species control. All the things that we talk about week in and week out out of habitat management is going to be at our habitat workshops at Michigan and Alabama in June and July. So we encourage you guys to look those over. That's at shoplandandlegacy.com. Field event tab, you can click on them and see all kinds of different stuff. It's new for us, but it's a great way for us to bring and basically hit different regions of the country. And so you guys that listen each week who may not have hired us for consulting can go and take that information you learn there and go improve your farm with it. So please check it out and enjoy this week's podcast. All right, guys, welcome back to Land O'Lakes Podcast, and we are super excited to jump right in head first into this podcast. We had this man on last year, and we couldn't wait to bring him back this year when everybody started talking, thinking turkeys. So without further ado, Dr. Michael Chamberlain, thanks for joining us.
Not a problem, guys. Glad to join you.
And I've got Matt calling in. Matt will probably, he's jumping in from teleconference as well, so it's all three guys merged in together. But let's just go right to it. In case people haven't heard last year's podcast, Mike, if you don't care, share a little bit about your background and how you got into dealing with wild turkeys.
Yeah, so I grew up a suburban kid, weekend warrior dad, if you will. Hunted every weekend I could and ended up going to school studying wildlife science, and was fortunate enough to do okay in school and get some opportunities to go to graduate school. And I actually started studying turkeys as a grad student on a project back in Mississippi back in the early 90s, and I've actually been studying turkeys every year since. I left graduate school and was fortunate enough to be hired in an academic position and in a research position, and been studying turkeys ever since as an academic as well. So I think I'm going on about my 28th year now of studying this bird.
Wow. What, over the course of the years, what has been some of your research that you've done that you've been most, I guess, shocked by or fascinated by? Something that you were like, you know, I had the assumptions that a bird with the turkey was like this, but it turns out that was false. Is there anything in the past that kind of earth shattering for you?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I'd say the one that sticks out the most to me is, some work I actually published that we now know is false. I did some work back in the 90s that seemed to kind of suggest, which some other researchers had suggested as well, that hens would go and spend some time selecting nest sites, and they'd go pick the best spot, and they would visit those sites before they started laying eggs and et cetera. And with the advent of GPS, we now know that they don't do any of that. They literally don't visit the nest site until the day they lay the first egg. In fact, most hens don't go anywhere near their eventual nest site until the day they lay that first egg. So that kind of blew my mind, and it actually refuted something that I had published previously, and not that I was, you know, not that I was wrong per se meaningfully. I just was inferring things based on the technology we had at the time, and the GPS telemetry has kind of revolutionized the way we think about the bird.
Yeah, so I guess this is an assumption that I'll make, or what kind of over the course of years of mainly just hunting the bird, do you feel in all your research, and I'm going to make you kind of, I'll try to pull you away from a real, I guess, professional response, but do you feel like turkeys, based on that, I mean, I feel like as a hen and getting ready to lay eggs for the next generation, she would put a little bit more thought into it than what it sounds like she's done. Do you feel like, for the most part, turkeys are kind of just going with the flow, if you will, and there's not really a whole lot of forward thinking of, I'll nest there and I'll fly down and by tomorrow afternoon I'll be over in this field?
I think the data suggests that they just are going about living their lives, and their bodies physiologically tell them, hey, it's time to nest, and they go find a spot and they lay eggs. We have actually found, which is really, to me, is super interesting, that most hens prioritize survival, their own survival. And that makes sense. This bird's supposed to live a long time, and they're not supposed to be like, say, bobwhite quail that are, you know, super prolific and geared towards making reproduction work 1 year because they may not live to their next year. You know, turkeys aren't like that. So it does seem that most hens prioritize their own survival over reproduction, which is pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, for sure.
And I believe some research has suggested too that when a hen is successful 1 year in raising a brood or having a successful nest site, she tends to be successful in the following years, whereas those who were unsuccessful may continue that trend from year to year. Is that right?
Yeah. That's we've absolutely shown that very clearly. That in reality, a really small percentage of your hens in a population contribute most of the reproduction that you see.
Hmm.
Do you think those hens just have this more motherly instinct potentially that they exhibit over the other ones that are more of the day-to-day, hey, survival is more of my contribution to the population, whereas there's other hens that say, hey, I'm a little bit more motherly, I'm going to put a little bit more energy into a nest in a great location, or just have more instincts to protect the poults once they've hatched?
That's a tough question. It looks like that just some hens are wired differently to do all of that, and we don't really understand that equation, but it just looks like certain hens are wired to do things differently, and that confers them a better advantage when it comes to hatching a clutch.
Sure.
What that is, we don't know. We haven't really been able to measure it, but yeah, some hens are just better at their jobs than others. I guess that's the easy way to put it.
Sure.
Gotcha.
Sure.
Okay. Well, and as we're looking at a wild turkey over the course of the year, can you break down basically habitat features that they would need to survive and basically sustain a population within a year? So I'll list out the ones that I know most common, and if I miss any, you can fill in. But like brood rearing habitat, nesting habitat, roosting areas, loafing area, what are some of the other, I guess, areas that a turkey would use from day to day or season to season in the course of a year?
That's pretty much it. I mean, if you kind of look at a bird's annual cycle and how they go about their day, you know, turkeys they sleep in a tree for a reason. You know, roosts are critical sites for this bird because they they're safe, presumably, although they're not always safe on the roost, but you know, those are places where they feel safe and they can protect themselves from inclement weather. They can protect themselves from predation, from us, if you will, at times. The other thing that we've seen with turkeys that, you know, during their day-to-day activities, they spend a lot of time loafing around. And when they're not loafing around, they're obviously foraging, but both of those places they need to be able to see. So this is a bird that has a periscope type head, right? And that head is, I mean, they make a living by being able to see trouble before it gets to them. So that's what drives turkey habitat is the ability for that vision to kick in. And then during the reproductive season, you know, if your hens particularly, it's, can I hide and not die while hatching this clutch? And we see nest sites that are all over the map as far as what they look like, but we don't see as much variation in brood cover. Brood cover is pretty straightforward. I mean, you need succulent herbaceous plants that are going to hold a lot of insects, that are going to be structured in a way where poults can move around. I kind of give people the analogy. If you want to know if you're looking at turkey habitat from an adult's perspective, just sit down on your knees. And if you can see around you, then so can they. If you want to look at the world from a poult's perspective or nesting hen, get on your belly and look around you. And that's the way they see their environment. So if you're trying to hide and you can lay on your belly and you can't see around you, then so can she. And conversely, if you're a poult and you're trying to move around, you lay on your belly and you look around and you can't see how to move, then neither can they. So it kind of ultimately all boils down to, you stick all that mess that I just said into a pot, it's basically early successional plant communities. That's turkey yeah. habitat, whether it's in a forest or under forest or in the wide open. It's early successional plants.
Hmm. Well, that sounds like that could go hand in hand with some other species that people love to manage for and grow, like the white-tailed deer. Oh, Matt, you got a question follow-up that? I thought I heard you chirp in.
You know, I think I'm definitely in agreeance. I love hearing that. I love hearing the research side of it come in and suggest the same things that we often discuss, and that's diversifying the habitat and having multiple stages of regeneration through the use of prescribed fire and just managing different types of plant communities, both in timber settings as well as, let's say, old field settings. Both of them are certainly applicable. But I think what you hinted on and discussed is, you know, as a landowner, speaking to landowners right now, you know, it's important to be able to change your perspective. And sometimes that literally means just taking a knee in the landscape and seeing and deciphering, looking at the structure of what's out there or what's not out there, if adequate cover or plant communities exist. And sometimes literally just need to get on the right level with the poults or with the wild turkey to be able to decipher that. And I think a lot of times if we do change that perspective, then you're going to see that things are probably inadequate. And, you know, that's what we see across the board and a lot of places. And I'm just glad to hear you're saying, reinforcing the need for early successional plant communities. And that, like you said, comes from, my gosh, it could be in timber, it can be in fields, it can be in semi-open timber. So there again is diversity.
Yeah, it's diversity, and it's often driven by disturbance, as you both know. Mm-hmm. I mean, the plant communities that this bird uses in not in all, but in most systems is disturbance driven. I mean, this bird benefits from things that we do to the environment that stimulate the seed bank, that stimulate vegetation, whether it be fire or timber thinning or mechanical treatments. I mean, you name it. Anything that stimulates the seed bank is generally going to be positive for this bird.
Yeah, that's awesome. So stepping back, when we're talking brood rearing, I think it's important, hopefully for people, listeners, I think a lot of times people wouldn't really know what they may have it on their own farm, but not really be able to say, oh, okay, I didn't realize that was brood rearing habitat or that was nesting cover. And it sounds like they both can be very similar. So is there any way, how would you define the difference between brood rearing habitat or brood rearing areas versus nesting areas?
Generally with our nest sites, now I'm kind of speaking in generalizations here, because every site we go to is a little different, but we've tracked, and we've got over, 800 nests we've looked at this point, and hundreds of brood sites where these broods have taken poults and spent time, whether they were roosting or whether they were hanging, you know, moving around during the day. And the general trend is with nest sites, you tend to see more woody cover than you do at brood sites. So in other words, think a sapling, multiple saplings, shrubs, things that are more likely to hide a bird versus brood cover, which is almost without exception open plant communities, like where a brood hen could stand there and clearly see in every direction what's happening. Now, again, there are exceptions, but that's generally what we see. The nest sites tend to be super variable as far as what's there, but the trend tends to be there's often pretty dense screening cover on at least one side of the nest. There's usually some kind of opening where she can get in and out of the nest. So words, one direction may be more open than the other three because that's where she comes and goes from. Whereas you can imagine, you flushed hens off a nest or seen nest sites. Some of these places are fairly open, but some are super, super thick. But brood sites are not. Brood sites are, they are open, sometimes wide open, particularly where birds may roost. They may tuck a brood up against some logs or some debris, wide open hardwoods. They may forage in areas where there is standing grass, but they can move around under it. So think like ragweed and some species like that that grow a little bit taller, but tend to be associated more with bare ground under them. That's the type of cover we see with broods. I'll be honest, one of the biggest things we see with broods, which I think is pretty interesting, we see them using fallow food plots a lot. Mm-hmm. And y'all have seen this, that, you know, you plant wheat, oats and clover or something in the fall, those plots come up, they're beautiful. We get about right now, they start getting kind of rank, deer stop eating them. Fast forward 2 months from now and they're brown senescent stalks, you know, they're dead, they've seeded out, they're starting to lay over, but you got this green clover that's under there. We see a lot of brood use of those plots, and if you kind of get out and look at it from their perspective, it makes sense because it's pretty open on the ground and there's a lot of bugs, there's a lot of insects moving around in those areas, but there's enough cover with those stalks of wheat or oats or whatever to kind of protect those poults from raptors and birds of prey. So it kind of makes sense. And we see broods when they have those, you know, those areas available to them. We do see a lot of use of them.
I think that's a great point. You know, there seems like a lot of people may tend to think that, oh, if I'm not actively managing a food plot, then it's not a benefit. Right. But in reality, here's a perfect scenario of where poults that need very specific habitat to be able to bug and have that high insect diet, they've got that in a fallow field, a fallow food plot that you didn't come back and plant in the spring. and just left it alone, and now it's providing really critical habitat. So that's good to hear for the people out there thinking, oh, I'm behind the eight ball if you're not planting in the spring. Not necessarily the case.
Yeah, a mess up, you can say. I planned it.
Yep.
Yeah, even a failed food plot would be pretty applicable too, with the amount of potential bare ground that it would offer and the foraging aspects of it.
Yeah, we actually see, I've seen several brood sites where broods were actually using, it wasn't just what was planted in the plot, it was actually some of the herbaceous, I mean, a food plot guy would or gal would call it a weed, but those natural plants, you know, or will often take over, particularly late winter if you've got heavy browsing pressure from deer. You'll actually see more weeds in your plots than the forage stuff you planted. And that's not always bad because it gives structure and provides green forage, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's you said that weed thing because you see it in the deer world all the time where it's like, how do I control these weeds? And you end up looking at the picture and you're like, it's ragweed. Why are you wanting to control that?
Yeah, and ragweed's actually a high-quality browse species in a lot of areas too.
Yeah, for sure.
Great cover, great structure, yeah.
Do you think, going back to the nesting cover, I'm trying to picture, because this podcast is really going to key in on for guys that are landowners and taking your research and applying it. Do you feel like, I guess this is an assumption of mine, I could say that where I see guys trying to manage for deer, turkey, quail, and all their native species, but going, okay, how can I make better nesting cover? How can I make better brood rearing cover based on what I have now? And I would imagine, based on all the travels Matt and I do consulting, that it seems like probably the open areas that could be great brood rearing oftentimes are too thick in grasses. And then the nesting cover where there is saplings and shrubs, they typically get the fire or disturbance has not occurred on a regular basis, where there's almost too much woody vegetation to where it's dense and the hens nesting will likely only use the fringes. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. And in my travels across the country, and admittedly, most of my time is spent in the Southeast because that's where most of my research is right now. But I travel all over the place in the spring to turkey hunt. So I see a lot of different areas, probably not as many different sites as you guys do, but I would wholeheartedly agree with that. What I tend to see is that areas that we think that's good nesting cover is too thick. It's actually, it's too woody. The stem density is too high. In some areas, that's combined not only with high understory stem density, but basal area that's too high as well. And then brood cover, I see a lot of areas where I'll talk with somebody and say, hey, what do you think? And they say, well, it looks pretty good. And I'm like, well, that's Bahia grass. Mm-hmm. That's a monoculture Bahia grass, or that's fescue or whatever. And those are thatch forming grasses, and that's not brood cover until they're older poults. And that's a key that a lot of people, I think, don't recognize is you got to get them through the first couple of weeks. And once they're 2 or 3 weeks old, they are, I'll say this, and I mean it literally, they become like plastic. I mean, poults and broods, they'll use all sorts of different stuff because they're growing bigger. They can fly. They can roost off the ground. They eat a bunch of different stuff. But when they're 3 days old or 5 days old, they are insect eaters. They're small and they need to be able to move around. And the only way to do that is to have open conditions on the ground. Think dirt, think bunch grasses that are like andropogons and species that are going to provide structure and not this dense mat of stuff.
Yeah.
And if you do, then you give them a shot, because that's when most broods are lost. We see overwhelming loss it is the first 5 to 10 days. If they get up to about day 14, they're in pretty good shape. So people need to think, it doesn't have to be dog hair thick to hide a nest. Literally knee cover, like knee top, is more than adequate. And brood cover, you need to be able to lay on your belly and look around and be able to move.
But what about, can you talk real specifically or quickly, I guess, about that spatial aspect of nesting cover and then brood rearing cover? Because we're talking about, you know, this 3-5 day old poult, they have to be able to mobilize from the nest to this brood rearing cover. So this kind of speaks to the need for the diversity across the property and even bare dirt. So like how important is it to have these types of habitat specifics in close proximity to get them to that, let's say 10 day, 14 day old size?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we actually just published some work that specifically hits on that. We found that broods that have to travel more than about 800 yards during the first 3 or 4 days of their lives, they get smoked. Mm-hmm. So in other words, if you've got a brood that hatches right here and she has to move that brood 1500 yards away over the next 2 or 3 days to get to a place where she thinks she can make it work, the survival probability of that brood is literally almost zero. Whereas if she can keep them relatively close to where she hatched, but not at the nest site, obviously they move away from the nest site. But if she doesn't have to travel that far, that confers her brood much higher success. So it directly speaks to the diversity issue. We need these habitats, these structures, these plant communities. We need them juxtaposed. We need them right beside each other. And we need to be thinking smaller patches rather than, hey, I've got 500 acres of nesting cover. Well, you don't need 500 acres of nesting cover. You'd be better off to have a certain amount of acreage in nesting cover and then brooding cover right beside it. That would be a more ideal scenario.
Sure. So in my head, I'm picturing like, yeah, you basically, instead of making a 5-course meal where everything's spaced out on the plate and different, you're basically dumping it all in and making a casserole where there's a little bit of everything all around.
Yeah, and you know, guys, I mean, early researchers and scientists, Aldo Leopold noted this back in the 1930s, you know, I mean, that diversity is key, and we've known that. I mean, we've known it for a lot of species, and yeah, I mean, the ideal scenario is these birds wouldn't have to travel far, and the way to keep their home ranges small and keep their movements down is to ensure they have all of their needs in a smaller area, and patch diversity and diversity of vegetation. That's one way to do that.
Okay, there you go. So let's go right into, as we're basically all that research that you've done and what we know now, how does a landowner with, let's say, 50 acres take that information and use it to where he can say he's actually making a difference for the wild turkey?
Good question. I kind of take two slants. When people ask me this, landowners ask me this, the first thing I'll tell them is take a look at your property and see where your strengths are. Where do you think, based on what you know about turkeys or what a biologist or somebody can tell you about turkeys, okay, where are my strengths? Maybe your strengths are in, you've got some pretty solid winter habitat. Let's say you got 50 acres and most of it's hardwood. You got a lot of mass-producing oaks, and you see turkeys every winter. Well, is there anything you could do to improve habitat during other times of the year? Maybe the answer is, okay, well, I've also got the chance to produce some brood cover, because we tend to see, at least in the South, that most nesting occurs outside of hardwood areas. Most nesting occurs in either mixed or pine dominated type sites. Okay, I've got pretty good winter habitat. I don't have nesting cover, but maybe I could do some things to improve brood cover, such as releasing some of my co-dominant oaks, improving forest structure, you know, understory structure, making the understory more diverse. Maybe I do some timber stand improvements, et cetera. The second thing I tell that person is, okay, well, where around you, what neighbor or what neighbors have property that addresses your weakness? So in other words, where are your birds going when they disappear? It's a common thing, and I know you hear this too. I had birds in the winter, they disappeared. Well, where did they go? They went to one of your neighbor's properties. What does he or she have that's your weakness? And could you work with them to address those weaknesses so that you both end up the better for it? And then if you keep doing that and you make a bigger and a bigger and a bigger footprint, you are going to have a positive effect on your local flocks because the footprint gets large enough to where you may only own 50 acres, but your mindset and your abilities and your knowledge have impacted a much larger footprint because you're willing to reach out to your neighbors. That's usually how I answer that question.
So if you're in that boat of, you know, smaller scale, less than 100 acres, it'd probably be best to kind of form some sort of, well, we know it'd be better even if you were 1,000 acres to form some sort of cooperative to work with your neighbors to where you're all trying to, maybe you have the information, but educate them on what needs to be done, how to make the biggest impact the quickest way possible, and then address the gaping holes in your habitat that could that need to be filled for the turkey.
I completely agree. I think cooperating is the bottom line. Is not very few people own enough acreage to really contain a flock of birds all year. So, and I know I'm generalizing, but there aren't many of us out there that own that much property. So those of us, and I don't own any property except what my house is sitting on, but if I were a small private landowner, I would be absolutely looking at ways to work with my neighbors in hopes that we could all see a greater positive impact. And even if let's say I own 5,000 acres, if I could identify a neighbor that also owns some property and we could make that footprint 6,000 acres, well, that's better. If we can make it 10,000 acres, that's better. And you guys see this in your line of work. I mean, I can point to numerous examples of these co-ops where folks put their heads together and they may not always share the exact same common vision, but they all want the same thing and they're all willing to invest resources in it. They're seeing positive effects of those types of situations.
Yes. I think that's definitely true. When you look, let's say beyond your property and extend that arm out there and say, hey, this is a landscape issue, and you address it from that landscape issue, the results, I think, can be certainly astounding. So what would you say is the typical, and if the research is from the Southeast, that's totally fine, but would you say is the typical range of a flock of turkeys throughout an entire year? What is the landscape usage that you're seeing through GPS?
We see about, on average, okay, so I'll start in the winter. The winter is by far their largest home range sizes. We see pretty extensive movements. As you can imagine, it's highly variable across flocks. You know, this flock of hens, for instance, may use 1,000 acres in 1 month, and the next flock uses 5,000 acres. But think thousands of acres for winter habitat. They are covering some ground. Exceptions would be bumper mass crop years. We see much lower home range sizes, but in a typical, just an average year, winter is the time where home ranges kind of explode and birds start moving around in large groups. They eat a lot because there's a lot of them. and they're looking for acorns for the most part, or waste grain, depending on where you live in the U.S. And then right about now, you know, we're in early March, and right about now we start seeing these groups are splitting up and their home ranges are starting to shrink quite a bit. We'll have the typical hen may use during her pre-laying period, which is kind of what we call right now, which she's split up from her big winter flock, but she's still hanging around with a few hens. They'll use hundreds of acres, maybe up to 1,000. And then when they start getting to the laying period, of course, they're kind of tethered to that nest site, but they're still using hundreds of acres. And then, of course, when they get to the incubation, they're, you know, they're using a handful of acres around their nest site. Then you see that it kind of reverses itself during the summer. If they hatch, then they use a few acres the first day, a few more acres the second day, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If they fail, then they typically their summer home ranges are just a couple hundred acres. They don't move much. They hang around with each other. They loaf a lot, as you can imagine. They find shade. They find areas that are cooler. Toms, on the other hand, toms are crazy. They will cover some ground in the winter. And then right about now, they're shadowing hens, and they're identifying places where they can go and display, and their home ranges will shrink down to 1,000 acres or so during the spring. And then come summer, they shrink dramatically. Once breeding season's over, they get back in those little small groups of toms, and just like hens, they're just using a couple hundred acres. So that's what I hear from a lot of landowners too. It's like, well, I didn't have birds all spring, and now all of a sudden I'm seeing turkeys on my property. Well, all they did was shift their home range a little bit, and they ended up on your property, and you'll probably see them consistently. If you see them at all during the summer, you usually see them consistently because they aren't using much space. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden come winter, they like explode, and they're like, well, now they're gone again. Yeah, because they may be 3 or 4 or 5 miles down the road on your neighbor's property because, again, their home range is dramatically increased during the winter. So to answer your question, literally everything from a few acres when they're incubating to a few thousand acres at a time during the winter. That's what you see.
Gotcha. So let's imagine that you're a landowner, 500 acres, and you're taking your research. What would be some of your top practices, whether it be prescribed fire, or timber stand improvement, or timber operation? What are some of your favorites that you would most likely utilize to make habitat for the wild turkey?
Dude, I'm a fire guy. I love fire, man. And, you know, this bird is inextricably linked to prescribed fire in the South. So I tend to be a pyro at heart, but I do see a common problem across the region in many places relative to fire. And that is, one, it's not applied frequently enough. Two, it's often applied repeatedly during winter, which tends to shift the plant community more towards woody plants. And three, I see a lot of fire used in stands where the basal area, the stocking density is too high.
Yep.
So you don't really get the benefit of the fire because all you're doing is burning up needle cast. So I'm a fire proponent. I'm a proponent of using fire at an appropriate scale, obviously, which we've documented pretty clearly is in the 50 acres, no more than 500 acre range, at least in pine dominated areas. And I'm also a fan of, expanding fire windows. Don't just think, you know, January, February, think March, think early April, depending on where you are and where your nesting is occurring. Think September, October. I mean, think outside the box and use fire if the habitats that you have will support the use of it. Of course, timber stand improvements, and like we just talked about, I mean, basal area is often, I see basal area is often a lot higher than it should be. And so if you're in a situation where you can do some timber harvest and some thinnings, things that are going to open up the canopy and put sunlight on the ground, that's generally a positive for turkeys. If you can manage what comes up in the understory.
Mm-hmm.
Another big one that I use myself, and I've got a bunch of folks that I help with their properties that I encourage, is disking. Just a light spring or a fall disking to stimulate plant communities on the edges of food plots or transition areas, places where you don't really need to plant per se. All you need to do is scratch the ground a little bit and stimulate the native plant community. Some of the species we've talked about, like ragweed and some other native forbs and legumes, just go nuts, as you know, when you disturb the ground. So those would be my biggies.
All right, Matt, dare I?
Yeah.
Dare I?
Yeah, well,
I just ask you what practices you would utilize most, Mike. And I'm so happy. I didn't even hear you mention trapping. It seems like you have a bigger emphasis on habitat management.
Yeah, you're gonna probably get me shot here, but
well, we'll get shot with you because we're here every week saying this.
This is a safe place. This is a safe place.
Yeah. No, I mean, first and foremost, and I've said this in other forums, and I'll say it here, and I'm not ashamed to say it, nor will I shy away from it, is, you know, trapping can be a beneficial practice. It can be effective at improving nest success and fledgling survival and birds in general. But if you're thinking about trapping, be thinking about other things. Be thinking about more, not just hoping that it's a silver bullet, because it's not. Be thinking about ways that you could implement habitat improvements while also enjoying the art that is trapping. If you want to trap, go for it. But first, sure, and foremost, we need people to focus on habitat first and foremost, and then you can focus on all sorts of other issues. But when I travel around, I see a lot of predators, but I also see habitat that in a lot of cases is really poorly managed. And some of that is not from intent, guys. Some of that is just from a lack of knowledge or a lack, sure, of information available, which is why you guys do what you do, is just, you know, to help people understand how to do it. And a lot of times, if people understand how to do it, they'll do it, particularly if they're vested in this bird, and there are tens of thousands of people, you know, of landowners that are.
Yeah. Well, so with, very well said, with those practices, it sounds like you kind of have a pretty good idea, but are there practices that you see people not doing enough in general? And you can talk Southeast and Midwest basically with that, and anywhere there's turkeys. But, and then do you see other practices that people utilize too often that aren't really ever going to get them the results that they're expecting? Is there anything that really jumps out at you?
Yeah. One thing that jumps out at me that's used too much, I'll start at the end, is a bush hog.
Yep.
Man, stay off the bush hog. It doesn't have to look clean and manicured. And I know I like my yard to look great too, but sometimes staying off the bush hog for a little longer period of time can be helpful. I tend to see one thing that's used, not enough, would be timber stand improvements, thinnings, and ways of opening up forest structure where you can get sunlight to the ground. I tend to see, and maybe I'm just paying more attention than I did 30 years ago, but I tend to see that basal area across many, many thousands of acres of land is way too high. We've got pine forests that are 100 plus basal area that are in short rotation type forest. You know, that's not ideal turkey habitat. So I end up often recommending almost every property I visit. Frankly, almost everyone I visit, I'll end up saying the basal area is too high. You know, consider doing some timber work. Consider getting a, you know, consulting with a forester, or identifying ways where you could improve forest structure, and not just in pines, but in hardwoods. And that's another thing I see that is often a misconception, is that hardwoods can't be managed with cutting.
Mm-hmm.
And as you both know, that's not true. You can go into hardwood dominated stands and actually improve acorn yield and structure with some careful harvest. And you can also generate some good, you know, revenue as well. So I think people get lulled into this custodial management of hardwoods. In other words, let's just leave it alone and it'll be fine. And sometimes that's just not the case.
I think that's great advice. A lot of times in our discussions, we're rather than discussing basal area for a landowner, we may reference percentage of a canopy opening. In a hardwood setting, Mike, what would you say is a really good ideal percent of canopy opening for turkey habitat, quality turkey habitat, if you're experiencing, you know, if you're going to follow up with fire and manage that understory, what kind of percentage of open canopy would you want in a hardwood stand?
Ooh, that's a tough question. And I'm sitting here with my wheels are spinning a little bit.
He's going to say it depends. How about this? North slope versus south slope. Would you have a different percentage-wise on those two sites?
Yeah, because you got one site that's considerably more productive than another. That those south-facing slopes, as you know, are going to generate different plant communities and they're going to react to disturbance a little bit differently. I'm not going to say it depends, but I'm going to say it depends.
That's fine. That's fine. That's our answer for us.
Yeah, what I have seen is that in areas where sweet gum is problematic, The whole equation changes, because the way that plant sends out, the way its root system works and the way it's these parent trees populate the landscape, it's a different ball game when you open up a canopy and you start disturbing sweet gum because it gets really mad. So I think when I look at areas and I start thinking about, okay, what's going to happen if I tweak this? If sweet gum is one of the plants that I'm dealing with, then I think a little bit differently, because I've seen such issues with it when there was disturbance that allowed it to go nuts, particularly if fire is not used in a way that it can continually cause it, you know, burn the sprouts back. Gotcha. That's one issue. The other issue I've seen is in areas where you have Japanese stiltgrass.
Oh,
yes. That has been like the story of the last 2 months from Adam and I working. It's just, we're seeing it popping up in so many different places. And I think that it really has an impact on loafing areas for turkeys. We're seeing a lot in the wet soils, the bottom land, where nice breeze would blow through, but a little bit of sunlight, that stuff goes crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's terrible. And we actually, this is a bit, it's a bit sad, honestly, but we actually see brooding occurring in stiltgrass areas, preferentially. In other words, they go to areas with stiltgrass, and that's alarming to me, because if they're going to stiltgrass areas, that means that the native plant communities are not producing enough forage to support them, and that is, to me, is a huge flag.
Yeah.
When I start thinking about disturbance and stiltgrass, that's another plant that kind of throws a wrench in the ointment, if you will.
Do you feel like that stilt grass, the birds going to bug in stilt grass, do you feel like in those sites that it's more common, or that it's because the native vegetation is almost, the herbaceous plants is almost non-existent? Or is it because it's the, I was hoping that people weren't saying, well, it sounds like Japanese stilt grass is doing more than the natives, but it's just that the natives aren't there and the stilt grass has done okay in that closed canopy forest, and so therefore they're using that. Okay.
That's exactly right. So the native species can't, the canopy's too closed.
Mm-hmm.
So they can't respond. There's nothing to stimulate them in the seed bank. But stilt grass can make a living in those shady kind of dappled sunlight areas. So, you know, a hen goes, well, hell, this is what I've got. It looks better than anything else. So I'll go there. And then I look at it and think how frustrating and sad that this stand is so poorly managed that's the primary. Yeah. That's the best they've got.
No. Mm.
Yeah. Man. Well, I mean, we see the same thing with different wildlife species with deer and areas. Let's just say they're riddled with bush honeysuckle.
I was thinking and autumn olive.
Like, well, that's autumn olive, or yeah, I'm saying same thing. A woody shrub. It's like that's the best cover that they have, and literally it's a non-native invasive that's completely taken over the understory, and the future is not bright for that site as a landscape, land stewardship mindset, land ethic. It's frustrating to see, but that's the state of sometimes the properties we visit or the properties that people are owning, and we're seeing this across not only deer but obviously wild turkeys too.
Yeah
absolutely.
Well, Mike, I know we don't want to take up any more of your time. We know you've got other appointments, so we appreciate you coming on. I think that a lot of people out there listening to this hopefully took away and now can have an idea of what they need to be doing. Basically, it sounds like cutting, disking, burning, and adding disturbance any way you can.
That is the key, man. No question.
Well, there you go, Matt.
Love it.
We'll just pound, just keep driving that nail home each and every week, because that seems like the going trend that we're doing here. So, Mike, appreciate coming on.
Not a problem, guys. It's good being with you.
Thank you, sir. Take care.
Yes, sir.
Yep.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.